Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's roundtable, we are discussing coverage of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into the Trump administration's ties to Russia. On Monday, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort and his business associate Rick Gates were indicted for a long list of crimes, including money laundering. That same day, Democratic lobbyist Tony Podesta stepped down from the Podesta Group, the powerful lobbying firm he founded with his brother John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign chair. We will connect the dots on today's show. And also, we're talking about coverage of the online political ads hearing this week on Capitol Hill. Executives from Facebook, Google, and Twitter testified. And then later in the show, we'll discuss the sad and unfortunate news we got this week. New America Media and its parent organization, the Pacific News Service, are shutting down. For the past 20 years, New America Media has championed ethnic journalists and ethnic media outlets. And Sandy Close, founder and executive director of New America Media, will join us later in the show. Joining us now are two guests. Kevin Hall is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and chief economic correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers based in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Hi, Scott. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Great to be with you, Rose.
Great to have both of you. There's a lot to talk about. But as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out. So, Kevin Hall, what caught your attention this week?
If we could do a little Homer picks, one of the stories that we ran out of here to this office this week was one about the new revelations coming out of Manafort and Papadopoulos and those revelations this week that kind of where things were, putting it against a timeline and kind of showing that there were three candidates still in the race and the Russians only wanted to talk to one, and kind of using the timeline based on these legal documents to kind of underscore how they weren't after just anybody. They were after Trump, and for a reason. The Russians being they, of course.
All right. And can you, we'll talk about this obviously during the show today, but how are you connecting these dots, Kevin? How are you and other reporters at McClatchy connecting these dots?
Well, I think it's we're all kind of in the same boat of trying to have a working timeline of when certain things like DNC hacks and Podesta's leaks and statements by Roger Stone and meetings with Donald Trump Jr. and Veselnitskaya and the Trump Tower meetings and trying to kind of put all these things together across a timeline. And then things, one of the things that's happened this week is that that timeline is filling in a more plausible way now, I guess.
All right, so kudos to your colleagues at McClatchy. And what about you, Scott Horton? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
I saw two things that I think are significant and that help us piece together what's going on in the special counsel's investigation. The first is a piece that ran on Thursday by Paul Wood in The Spectator. That's a UK publication, in which he reveals information he secured from Ukrainian investigators about Paul Manafort, his time in Ukraine, the amount of money he was being paid, and who was paying him, that shows he was receiving staggering sums, over $26 million over time for his efforts, and that the source of these funds is Russian money, by and large. And then the second, that continued up until March of 2016, so just before he came on the Trump campaign. The second is a piece by Betsy Woodruff that ran in the Daily Beast, in which she is combing through the details of the Manafort complaint and noting that one of the vendors that's involved there, that's used in this large money laundering operation as described by the U.S. government, is an entity that is controlled indirectly by Semyon Mogilevich, who is the biggest organized crime boss in Russia, one of the most dangerous men in organized crime in the world, and also a figure who appears in the backdrop of a number of of Donald Trump projects, including Trump Soho. So I think we're beginning to see a link emerging between the money around Paul Manafort, which we now total at, I think, over $140 million, mm-hmm. And that was flowing into the Trump empire itself. And I think we're seeing ties between the Trump empire and Manafort also emerging. So I think on the dollar trail, quite a bit is beginning to come into place.
Wow. So kudos to Paul Wood at The Spectator and Betsy Woodruff with The Daily Beast. And we will put links to these stories at yourcallradio.org. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. Kevin Hall is chief economic correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Is it safe to say, Kevin, that so many reporters in Washington are moving very quickly to get the scoop on this story?
Yes, it's awfully hard to keep track of it all because there's so many moving pieces. There's the component on the Hill. There's the Mueller investigation. We focused our efforts on our investigative team, of which I'm part, on the money trail and money laundering. So we've been looking at people longer, older associates of Trump and kind of establishing how this money flowed into Trump's businesses, you know, which helps make that case that this is a model that has been a consistent model. And he's always had an arm's length deniability. We don't really know where the money comes from. We're just we just lease our market, our name. We get paid for the brand, et cetera. So I think there's so many elements to where you go on this story, and it is staggering at times. It makes the head hurt. There's so much going on.
It does make the head hurt, even for those of us who read about these and are journalists. Scott, can you give us an overview of what is actually happening? I mean, from your perspective, what is most important at this point?
I think, you know, we're seeing a progressive move, you know, from the focus on social media and hacks to money. This is really becoming a much more follow the money exercise. And I think we're seeing a case developed that dark money from the former Soviet Union is what's in the backdrop of almost all the actors here. So Trump was clearly being fueled by it. Paul Manafort is also being fueled by it. And I think that dark money largely can't be clearly or easily identified. The names are coming up right away are oligarchs and mobsters, organized crime figures. But I think we're seeing increasing evidence that the Russian intelligence community is in the back and is pulling the strings and manipulating that. And I think one of the reasons we have to ask ourselves, why was the Papadopoulos complaint dropped and released when it was? There was no particular reason why that had to be disclosed on Monday, but I think this is the reason why. I think it shows, I mean, we talk a lot about collusion, which is not a legal theory or problem, but the pushback from Trump and his allies in the Rupert Murdoch media empire, and they really are acting in concert, has consistently been there's no collusion, there's no evidence of collusion. And then, you know, by the way, look at that lady over there, Hillary Clinton. You know, mm-hmm. that's where you should be investigating. And I think Bob Mueller wanted to make very clear that no, there really is very strong and very powerful evidence emerging of collusion and of engagement with Russian intelligence, and that's the reason why he allowed that conviction he'd already secured to be put on the record in a lot of detail about it. And it leads into some murky figures like the Maltese professor, and it's almost like Boris and Natasha from the cartoons.
Well, as you said, there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of names are being thrown around. Scott, what do we need to know about Trump's foreign policy advisor, George Papadopoulos, who pleaded guilty to making false statements to the FBI?
Well, when you look at his background, there's simply no way someone like this would have been hired following a vetted search for a senior campaign advisory function. He has a bizarrely weak background as a mediocre student at a second-tier school. Don't mean to insult people who went to DePaul, but, you know, that's the case here. And then he has an offshore track record, which is equally strange. So he's in London. He's at a law firm that no lawyers in London, where I practice, by the way, seem to know, and that seems to be moving its location, and that now is being that's being connected thoroughly with a Russian intelligence operation. So he was there. He had this connection with this Maltese professor, who I think everybody thinks is an almost cartoon character of a Russian spy or political operative. And he comes back and starts selling this inside the campaign. So it looks mighty suspicious. And I think the role of his immediate mentor within the campaign, Clovis, likewise, is attracting lots and lots of attention. And the fact that the campaign, senior figures in the campaign and the attorney general misled Congress and the public about all these events for months, and they've now been exposed as liars. That's pretty spectacular stuff.
Kevin, you and your colleagues at McClatchy have been on this story since the very beginning. Can you walk us through what you all have uncovered so far, the most important parts?
Well,
I'm talking specifically on the money laundering, and Scott said the most important thing to talk about is following the money. And you've got out with Ben Weider, who was on recently. Firm and Mueller indictment got RNC funds for work on Trump campaign. So, yeah, not the whole thing, but specifically what stands out for you about the money.
Yeah, now that was referring to Bait LLC, which was one of the companies made, and it's really instructive to look at Trump's tweets. If I can back up just one step to the Papadopoulos references, you know, look how he first was a coffee boy, he was a nobody, and now the White House is backing away from that and saying, well, maybe he was in meetings and maybe he did make this, you know. So it goes to the heart of, you know, how these guys got onto the campaign to begin with. And Sam reminding your listeners that Sam Clovis, who had been his supervisor in the campaign, has now stepped down from his nomination to the Department of Agriculture, where amazingly, probably even more shocking, was named, you know, had been appointed, was going to be the chief scientist for the USDA with a $3 billion budget, and he has no background in science, which is kind of mind-boggling. That said, Bade was a company Mr. Trump tweeted almost immediately after the Manafort indictments that this preceded the campaign. It was not something that really was affected him or the campaign. And in fact, Bade LLC, which is a company that Manafort, that Gates appears to have received money from his Ukraine business, that remained an active Delaware entity, and the federal election records show that we received three payments, two in 2016, one in January 2017 when Mr. Gates was on the inaugural committee, the inauguration planning committee, and was continuing to receive funds from the RNC and Trump for Trump-related activities. So, you know, that put lie to that. On a broader scale, what we've looked at, we've spent a lot of time looking at Trump Soho, because I think that's the development project and where you have to understand who his partners were when he got in business in 2004, 2005, when his interest in Russia really began. And from there, showing how that links to whether it's the Russian money in the Toronto project, whether almost all of his projects have some degree of, if not Russian funding, then Russians who are buyers of the units as well. So we've looked a lot at Felix Sater, who is has emerged several times during the campaign, one more recently in, when he and Michael D. Cohen, Mr. Trump's personal lawyer at Trump Organization for a number of years, floated a peace plan for Ukraine that came through politicians tied to Manafort. So that following the money is this complex web of characters who most of them actually go back a good ways in the Trump web. So I think that's where we've tried real hard to focus on our efforts, and you know, everybody's taken a slice of the story. There's so much to tell.
Mm. Kevin Hall is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and chief economic correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. We're also joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's, author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. And we're talking about media coverage of the Mueller investigation. And as both of our guests have said, there are so many moving parts to all of this, and I don't want to confuse anyone. So if you have any specific questions about what are the most important aspects of this, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about the media coverage? As Kevin said, Washington reporters are moving very fast to get the scoop. Are you getting the context you need and the reports that you've heard and you've read? What other questions do you have about why this is important? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Scott, there's been a lot of talk this week about laws that have been broken and what is and is not allowed under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which requires lobbyists who represent foreign governments, political parties, and other groups seeking to influence U.S. foreign policy to register with the DOJ. Can you talk about this and how that's being covered?
Yes, I mean, this is something that goes back now 30 years, roughly. You may remember the KCIA scandal and things like that back in the 70s. Congress decided that there would be no action on behalf of foreign powers in dealings with the U.S. government without a registration with the Department of Justice. And in this case, one of the most clear-cut violations that was established right at the beginning of the investigation into Manafort was that he was acting as an agent for the Ukrainian government. He was paid to do that, and he was, in fact, engaging with the government all over the place, and he'd never filed his FARA registration. So that's significant in many ways. I mean, it was an ongoing violation. Now, the U.S. Department of Justice's enforcement of these violations has been rather uneven. But in this case, it ties into money laundering. So I think if we look at this this indictment, there are 12 counts in it. But really right at the heart of it is a massive operation, a massive money laundering operation. When you have money laundering, you have to have a predicate criminal act. That is, there has to have been criminal conduct in the background that relates to the money and the use of the money, and the FARA violation provided that. So it's a key part of this overall complaint. But I would note a couple of things. You know, we see about $70 million identified involved here in money laundering. I understand, I've been told, that they've tallied more than $150 million in funds already. This is $70 million that came from the Ukrainian government or the Ukrainian political party. There's quite a bit more they're still trying to track and identify. So the amounts here are absolutely enormous.
Just in the charging documents in the statement the other day, were, I think, and your guest can help me on this, but if my memory is right, it's $18 million in undeclared earnings for work done in the Ukraine and Russia.
Right.
And
that's correct.
That's just the charging document. You know, the sums involved are much greater, and what is important to understand in the Ukraine is you've had this tumultuous political environment where the Party of Regions came out of nowhere with a lot of moneyed interest from Russia to build this party. Yanukovych, with Manafort's help, rises to run the country, only to flee in collapse. And you've had ties that rose, then were broken apart, and are kind of rising again. And there's kind of a general sensation that there's more out there that's just being withheld until there's some political use for those who are holding it. So we know there's a registry that has already been reported on that had ledgers, a ledger sheet that had payments to Manafort, but there's a whole component of this story that lots of people have been looking at with offshore accounts in Belize that have, this kind of ties back into the Panama Papers and how Russians and people in that part of the world have been using shell companies to hide movement of money. So there's that element, and there's a second ledger sheet that has references to Manafort, what seem to be nickname references to Manafort, to not name him directly. So there's a lot more out there that has been reported in pieces, but still hasn't kind of come together as a whole puzzle being solved. And I think that you're going to see in the coming weeks a lot, likely to see some stuff coming out of Ukraine itself that helps fill in some of these blanks.
And the New York Times has a story called Laundered $18 Million and How He Spent It. And it takes a look at, actually draws the lines between how Paul Manafort wired $18 million from offshore accounts to pay for a lavish lifestyle in the United States, including three homes, home improvement, hundreds of thousands of dollars on clothing and art, cars. We have this story up at yourcallradio.org. We have a question specifically about money laundering. Let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
A little bit more.
Lisa.
Maybe you could just really break it down. What actually is money laundering, and what actually, and that's illegal, and what is it hypothetically that may have occurred that Trump may have, or his associates may have been involved with, that was specifically money laundering?
All right. Kevin, do you want to take that?
Yeah, it's not an easy answer as to, in the simplest term, it's proceeds of illicit earnings that are washed through a legitimate transaction. So in the case of Trump Soho, if you have money that's been one of the allegations that the government prosecutors in Kazakhstan are making against the Krapunov family, is that they were part of a scheme to steal what they claim is $10 billion worth of money and then wash that money through investments. That makes it harder to recapture, because once you've washed it through something, you say, well, this was a legitimate transaction. See, a court has issued a settlement on it. Like here, there were some cases settled through the courts here. Or Trump Soho, this money flowed into, bought two condos at Trump Soho and then were flipped a year later. It makes it harder to recover that money. So that's kind of the hallmark of what laundered money is. In this case, it's a simpler definition. It's money that is undeclared revenue, the revenue they made from their consulting that they didn't declare for tax purposes, and then they used shell companies to pay here in the United States and launder that undeclared money into assets in the United States. But the key thing to watch, in my mind, and my fellow guest can weigh in on this if he agrees, is there's a very obscure count in the document, which is one that the prosecutors almost never fail on. It's called the failure to file an FBAR. The Bank Secrecy Act requires anybody who has a foreign bank account or a foreign financial anything investments abroad, you're asked specifically on your 1040 tax form, do you have that? It's either checked or it isn't. It's pretty cut and dry. And in the case of this document, they're saying clearly, not only did he not check it, but his tax return, the Mueller's team has talked to the tax preparer, who has told Mueller's team, we asked about this, and they answered in the negative. So that is a really hard one to argue around, and it does carry a penalty up to 5 years, and there are precedents where people who've been involved in arms trafficking and things like that, none of the other charges stuck, but the FBAR violation does stick, and I think that's the one to watch for.
How did Manafort wire money from Cyprus to, for example, South Carolina, Florida, Virginia, Beverly Hills? How did he do it?
He was wiring money in part to his vendors. I mean, so I think one thing that is very peculiar about this complaint, it talks about the lavish lifestyle, it identifies a series of vendors, and if you look at some of these vendors, things just don't stack up correctly. I mean, so we have a New York-based haberdasher where he spent, he spent $1.4 million total on men's clothing. Now, you look into the details here, and you see lots of bills ending in five zeros. I mean, walk into a men's clothing store and see if you can purchase something and have the purchase end in five zeros. Things are really concentrated in a short list of vendors with whom he's doing these transactions over and over again. I just suggest there's a strong suspicion here, I think, on the part of the FBI investigators that this is not simply a purchase of cufflinks and shirts, that this is a money laundering move, and that these vendors may be participating with others in receiving the money back.
Yeah, well, and one of the experts we talked described it as reckless, because it seems to be kind of ham-handed, that the way with which it's been brought in, and I don't know if there was just an assumption that I'm too big to go after. Or but on the face of it, it seems awfully reckless. Another little clue in there is he had 17 domestic entities that were named, and if I'm not mistaken, 15 foreign entities, 12 of those in Cyprus, and two in Grenadines and one in London. And the Grenadines is an interesting little clue there, because that is one of the fiscal paradises, one of the tax havens. They often give you a passport if you buy a condo or some small property. And the family that we've spent a lot of time tracking, the Krapunovs, the Kazakh family that's holed up in Switzerland, they managed to get a Grenadines passport to travel on, if my memory is correct, St. Vincent and Grenadines. So that makes you then question, has Mr. Manafort also been traveling on a foreign passport? We know from the documents that he now has three different U.S. passports with different numbers as well. So it's a lot to come out, but there are a lot of anomalies.
Well, thanks for the question, Lisa. We'll continue talking about money laundering after the break, and also more about the Panama Papers. This was an explosive investigative report by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that revealed a system of undisclosed offshore accounts, money laundering, and other illegal activity around the globe. And Kevin Hall was part of that team. He's chief economic correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A, more on the aftermath of terror in New York, and new mysteries in an old place, the Great Pyramid of Egypt. Coming up on 1A.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are discussing media coverage of the Mueller investigation. And if you have any questions or comments about this, there's a lot going on. If you are confused about it, or if you just want to know about a specific perspective on this, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite, and America's Stealth Warfare. Kevin Hall is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and chief economic correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Kevin, we have a lot of emails coming in about money laundering. And since you worked on that explosive Panama Papers investigation, can you talk about what came of this? Again, documents allegedly implicated world leaders, financiers, celebrities, very wealthy people from around the world, and the use of shell companies to conceal their assets. And the Office of the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York indicated that it's launching an investigation. I mean, governments from around the world were forced to take action on this, but what actually came of it?
Yeah, actually, it's been fairly disappointing that on a federal level, very little has been done, at least to date. And the new tax reform package unveiled this week is pretty much silent, and it would seemingly be the kind of place you could move to affect this as well. But what has changed here in the United States, at least, the states of Wyoming and Nevada, after our reporting specifically about how Russians in particular were using U.S. states as LLCs in these states, much in the way that American company might use Cayman Islands, they have changed some of the disclosure rules. And in the case of Nevada had this very bizarre law that basically the state secretary, which is in charge of incorporation in the state, could not even do a a general random test of compliance. They couldn't look at anything unless a subpoena came. And this was a marketing tool that we're so interested in your business, we don't want to know anything about your business unless we get a subpoena. And I think they've now come to see that that was an incentive for bad behavior, and they now have empowered the Secretary of State in Nevada to actually do random tests and encourage this random testing to check enforcement and compliance. And in the case of Wyoming, what we found is that Russian companies would have a name and then a nominee, their actual contact person that they gave the state of Wyoming was in the Seychelles, and it was a nominee director, and it wasn't even a person that existed, no evidence that this person even existed, and then that person was on another company who had a nominee director. So it was a shell game, and that's why they're called shell companies. Very little has changed, and the United States, particularly Delaware, remain very vulnerable unless law enforcement has a specific reason to be looking at these companies. It's hard to know. Mm. It's just awfully hard to know, and we've done very little on a world level. The Prime Minister of Pakistan recently was pushed out because of this, and you've got a bunch of things. The Malta, the terrible death of a colleague, Daphne, in Malta, as a reminder of what's at stake, because her son was deeply involved in the Panama Papers, was very instrumental in it, and it's not clear that there was a linkage. She was a very dogged reporter who went after people in high places in a lot of areas, not just the Panama Papers. But across the globe, it's had a lot of impact. In the United States, less than hoped, and that may change. You can see enough coming out of some of the offshore providers that there seems to be another leak, of which we may be hearing very soon, that will further amplify the need for greater disclosure and greater monitoring.
Scott, what are your thoughts on that? This got so much media attention, and as Kevin said, it didn't really have much of a difference, make a difference here in the United States. How do you think that will affect the Manafort case? Scott? Did we lose Scott? All right, I think we lost Scott. We'll get Scott back. In the meantime, let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show. Do we have William? Are we having phone problems? All right, I'll let them deal with that. What do you think, Kevin? I mean, given what has not happened in the U.S. as a result of the Panama Papers, how do you think the Bob Mueller case will be any different or similar? What are your thoughts?
Somebody's back here. Before I answer, did we get
hello?
Our guest back?
Do you hear me? This is William from Belvedere.
That's William from Belvedere.
Yeah, no one could hear me. You could hear me now.
Okay, go ahead, William.
I'd like to address the issue of the Russians paying for advertising on the media and the social media.
Okay.
Much has been made of that. Frankly, I'm not sure what everyone's upset about, because routinely media are paid for by various interest groups. For instance, in many ways, the Koch brothers and the Mercer organization are more foreign to me, and their ideals are more foreign to me than maybe the ideas that the Russian government is seeking. And I would appreciate the comment of the guest.
All right. Well, so this week, representatives from Twitter, Facebook, and Google testified on Capitol Hill about the influence of social media in the 2016 election. Before you tackle William's question, Kevin, what did you learn from the hearings?
Well, my colleague Greg Gordon had kind of been one of the pioneers in showing that this was happening. So I think for us it was kind of an affirmation. But what it showed clearly is that the Russian, what we presume to be the FSB or the competing GRU, the spy agencies in Russia, have had an active hand in trying to have disinformation campaigns. Now, if you read Spy Master, a wonderful book by Oleg Kalugin, who was the first big Russian spy to come in from the cold right after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, this is not new. This is something they've always done. What's different now is that the way you can do it in social media, they've been very agile with it. But it raises, I think, to flip the question, I think one of the things that we need to understand is it's asymmetrical. You know, Russia and China, for instance, both have enormous control over what goes on the internet, how it goes. U.S. companies, we've had to loosen some of the sanctions against companies in Russia and the Ukraine directly because internet activity, the simple ability to have a website in a country, is monitored and controlled by these governments. So I think one thing to me that it seems to be highlighting is the asymmetrical relationship, that our Achilles heel is our openness. People are sophisticated enough to know if it says sponsored ad that it's sponsored. When it doesn't say that, that's the difference. And I think if you look at the degree to which they put Black Lives Matter, the degree to which they, you know, respect the badge, I mean, they were very sophisticated in trying to get all these different points of view and kind of make everybody run at each other in a crowded theater. That was their strategy, and it has worked wonderfully, and we're working on some more stories that kind of help highlight how this is an ongoing operation as well. And for your caller, I would distinguish between what the Koch brothers do. I mean, they certainly fund things, and Citizens United has certainly made it a lot easier for corporations to have money in U.S. politics, so it's part and parcel to a bigger discussion. But more narrowly on the Russians, this really is without precedent in the way that they're using it in Holland, the way they're using it in France and Germany. You know, it's part of their geopolitical strategy, and that's very different than anything we've seen.
Scott Horton, are you back with us?
I am.
Okay, sorry about that. We had a caller who wanted to talk about the difference between the Russian ads that were placed on Facebook, Google, and YouTube, and, say, the Koch brothers and the Mercers, who bombard us with ads during the elections. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think Kevin has nailed it, pretty much. I think if we look at the Russian ads that have been disclosed now, they match up perfectly with the hybrid warfare doctrine we know that the Russians have been developing over the last several years. And the key distinction is stealth. So they will present themselves with a dozen different faces. They're the face of secession in California, independence for Texas. They're the face of some radical Islamic groups and people who are xenophobes, who are anti-Muslim xenophobes. So what they want to do is foment discord and anger and irrational thought, foment distrust of national institutions. And in this case in particular, they wanted to support Donald Trump, and they wanted to degrade the position of Hillary Clinton. But by the way, supporting Donald Trump, it seems, and I think we've seen evidence now, that as soon as Trump was elected, they flipped in several cases, and they were running agitation propaganda that was critical of Trump. So that comes back to this principal theme of undermining confidence in institutions.
Last year, Facebook brought in nearly $27 billion in ad revenue. Google generated almost $80 billion in ad revenue. Scott, where do you see this going?
Well, to me, the most amazing thing that's come out of this whole interchange is the absence of transparency on the part of major social media outlets. They denied something that they had to have known about, and it was only under immense pressure that they have come to accept what happened. And even now, I think they are probably still pretty dramatically understating the total scope of it. And the reasons, I think, are purely economic. It has nothing to do with political attitudes in one direction or the other. They don't want anything that would impose a filter on their revenues. So I think your question is just the right question. But I think they're being forced to propose self-monitoring and self-regulation. And I doubt that's going to be satisfactory, certainly not to many of the voices on the Democratic side that I hear. I think there's going to be legislation requiring higher levels of disclosure.
What do you think, Kevin?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly. I think that's clearly in the works. But there's also a broader question of simply access to our infrastructure. One of the stories that I remember, to me, still seems among the most striking, we weren't the first to do it, although we did get him and did a separate deeper dive into it, was a guy named Vladimir Fomenko. And for those who don't remember, he was a name that was associated with the first of the hacks, the election hacks, in Gila County, Arizona. He was alleged to have been behind that, or at least IP addresses tied to the servers that he operated. Turns out the kid is in a remote part of Siberia. He's never left Siberia. And he's got servers. He co-locates in servers in Fremont, California, and Garden City, New York, and Garden City, New Jersey, oddly enough. And how is it possible that a kid in Siberia can co-locate server space and then have clients filtering through the United States? It's an Achilles heel. I don't know how you combat it or change it, but the fact that anybody anywhere in Russia or China or anybody else who's a frenemy or hostile can simply co-locate on any server company they want and have access, you know, kind of a platform through which they can follow malicious intent. And I think that one of the things that this all is highlighting is, much like 9/11, how our openness is being used against us, and I don't know what the answer is to combat that.
Well, we'll definitely continue to follow this. Kevin Hall is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and chief economic correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers based in Washington. Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Scott and Kevin, thank you for your reporting and thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. Coming up after this quick break, we'll be joined by Sandy Close, founder and executive director of New America Media. Unfortunately, we got the sad news this week that New America Media will be shutting down on November 30th. That's coming up here on Your Call right after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this week we got the sad and unfortunate news that New America Media and its parent organization, the Pacific News Service, are shutting down. For the past 20 years, New America Media has championed ethnic media outlets and ethnic journalists. And joining us now is Sandy Close, founder and executive director of New America Media. She served as executive director of Pacific News Service since 1974, and in 1996, she co-founded The Beat Within, a weekly writing journal by incarcerated youth. Hi, Sandy. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. It's great to be on your show. Thank you so much for the interest.
Well, it's great to have you. And I was so sad to hear that New America Media is shutting down. I mean, at a time when so many journalists are losing their jobs, a lot of people were really in shock. Why did you all decide to make this decision?
You know, it's a case where frankly, years of taking many risks and seizing opportunities in this fantastic sector of journalism that we call ethnic media, I made miscalculations and I took missteps, always able through generous funders and donors to pull the rabbit out of the hat. But at some point realized, I think with my colleagues and my board, that it was not a sustainable model. That doesn't mean the work itself wasn't absolutely effective and vital. It meant that the organization as a nonprofit was overextended, under-resourced, and I just felt the time had come to wind down. So we're hoping that there will be ways to sustain the work. As you said, this is a time when, 20% of adults in California speak no English. Mm. If we're only looking at California, the role ethnic news organizations play in informing and engaging limited English proficient immigrant populations couldn't be more important at this point. But it's also been a sector that's been a profoundly important over decades and even centuries, an advocacy voice for communities that were invisible, misunderstood, stereotyped, or just simply isolated. And those are English-speaking. You have fantastic outlets like Hoopa Radio and the Two Rivers Tribune up in Hoopa, California. You have black press across the state that have kept their audiences, even as African Americans have dispersed from the cities where most of these outlets have operated. Why? Because they've been critical to giving communities a sense of, among other things, who passed last week and what's being said in our churches, what are the concerns of our civic leaders. Really a vital part of American journalism and communication. This isn't the time for us to be departing the scene. Unfortunately, I have to bear the bulk of the responsibility. I'm impatient. I'm opportunistic. I'm greedy to seize the moment, if you will, to see things done. And aspirations had long outpaced our budgetary constraints. So this is a point of failure, but I fully intend for most of us involved, very committed to hoping to support the work and that the work will live beyond NAM.
Sandy, so many of us in independent media are scratching our heads about what kind of business model would actually work to sustain the very important work that you all do. Would you have made any changes? And I know a lot of people are asking you, what can we do to make sure we don't shut down? So what advice would you give?
You know, I think being the great advantage of being in the nonprofit sector, frankly, is that we could take risks. We could dare to do things like when NAM started multilingual polling, which really hadn't been part of the whole public, the whole tradition of public policy polling had been English, maybe eventually some Spanish. But again, in a state like California, with 40% of households speaking languages other than the English, what was public about public opinion polls when they weren't in multiple languages? I think the ethnic media was so enthusiastic about giving voice to their audiences through multilingual polls. All of these initiatives we leapt into, often without really judging what the fiscal or financial impact and responsibility would be. So do I regret that? Do I regret that we kept programs going after the funding had run out? A lot of our youth programs are now successful, operating on their own as 501c3s, but I would say my strongest advice would be to get financial managers who you can work with, who can provide very strategic advice on how not to get too overextended. Once you get very overextended, you cut back, you restructure, but it then becomes, you know, the difficulties are there. And I think we had a great run, Rose, thanks to very dedicated staff and to ethnic media and youth development programs that were very mission-driven and supported and stepped up and took hold of initiatives, we started and ran with them. There are ways now where organizations that are like intermediaries that connect audiences that, say, government would find hard to communicate or hard to reach, where these intermediaries bring great value because of the trust they have in those communities. So let's say you have the 2020 census coming up. If you're an organization that truly can deliver information and communications, which means getting information back from these audiences, there could be monetary possibilities if you figure out activities. We used to call them civic engagement, or I guess media came up with the notion of civic engagement, but it's often too much the case of sort of one-way messaging out. I'm talking about really inside-out rather than outside-in communications. I think that has great value now, and it's high-touch often more than it is high-tech, but that means it's got tremendous value. We had found ways to support the work through leveraging this kind of intermediary role. And I think moving forward, if I had been more careful in allocating resources and not overextending us, I think we could have made a go of it. Now, that means that there are real models that come out of our experience that we'd be more than happy to share. But it is a very challenging time, and my main priority at this point is finding opportunities that will continue to support ethnic media reporters and ethnic media outlets that are desperately needed to keep communication bridges going to our very diverse communities in California and in so many other parts of the country.
Well, Sandy, thank you for joining us, and thanks for all you did with New America Media. I think it'd be great to have you and maybe a couple other longtime journalists on a panel to talk about this, because, you know, at a time when, especially in California, the state is swimming with money, and yet independent media outlets are having a really hard time finding sustainable models. So this is something that we really want to continue talking about, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on this, especially as all of this sinks in for you over the next month or so. We'd love to have you back.
Well, sure. And may I say my hats off to KLW for the fine work you've been doing to engage inclusive journalism in the Bay Area. So you also are a model for us and an inspiration.
Well, thank you so much, Sandy.
Thank you.
Sandy Close is founder and executive director of New America Media. They just announced that they will be shutting down on November 30th. For the past 20 years, they have championed ethnic journalists and ethnic media outlets. This is a loss for journalism, but hopefully I'm sure Sandy will reappear in doing her incredible work. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.